Hey, Dan here. Before we start the show, I want to tell you about a live recording of this podcast that we're doing in New York City on March 28th. I will be interviewing two frequent flyers from this show, the legendary meditation teacher, Joseph Goldstein, who will be just coming off a three-month solo silent meditation retreat, and Dr. Mark Epstein, a Buddhist therapist and best-selling author. The event will actually be a celebration of the 10th anniversary of my first book, 10% Happier, and a percentage of the proceeds will go to the New York Insight Meditation Center. Come early if you want for a VIP guided meditation and Q&A with me. Thanks to our friends over at Audible for sponsoring this show and the event. Tickets on sale right now at symphonyspace.org.
How do we want to do this, guys? Should we, Dan, do you want us to welcome you? Is that...
That's a good idea. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Should we just dive in?
Yeah, let's dive in.
Okay.
Let's do it.
It's going to be weird.
I would just say, as an overarching thing, we should enjoy this.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Good.
This is the 10% Happier Podcast. I'm Dan Harris. Hello, everybody. How we doing? This show would not exist. In fact, my whole career as a meditation evangelist or whatever you want to call it, none of it would exist if I had not taken a huge risk 10 years ago and put out a book called 10% Happier, after which this show is, of course, named. It really was a huge risk. At the time, as many of you know, I was a network news anchor, a co-host of Nightline, also the co-host of the weekend editions of Good Morning America. I also spent a lot of time traveling around the world doing investigative stories and covering breaking news. So to be in this position and to publicly admit that I had struggled with depression and then self-medicated with cocaine and that it all resulted in a panic attack on Good Morning America, well, as you can imagine, that was something of an out-of-the-box career move. And bear in mind, this was well before the current era where lots of people talk about their mental health challenges openly. While I was terrified that the book might torpedo my career, I did not actually think, even if I survived, that the book would amount to much. However, to my surprise, the book became pretty successful. It produced this podcast, and it allowed me to do something I never would have imagined, quit the news business and work in the world of mental health and happiness full time. Anyway, the book is turning 10 years old this month. I just put out a revised 10th anniversary edition of the book with a new preface and expanded appendix filled with meditation instructions. And to celebrate this milestone, we're kicking off a big series in which I'm going to go back and interview many of the major players from the book. So you're going to hear me talk to people like Deepak Chopra, who's never been on this show before, also Joseph Goldstein, Dr. Mark Epstein, and even my younger brother, who, if you read the book, played the role of snarky skeptic, was even more skeptical than I was about meditation, and has, however, to my delight, recently become a convert. We are kicking this series off today with an unusual episode where two of my producers, DJ Kashmir and Lauren Smith, interview me. We talk about the story behind the book, what it was like to have a panic attack on national television, why I decided to admit it publicly, how the success of the book utterly transformed my life, and what I learned during all of this, both while writing the book and subsequently. We talk about concepts such as respond, not react, why our faults are not our fault, but they are our responsibility, and whether every one of us has the capacity to change. DJ and Lauren will even weigh in on how they think I'm doing on the change front these days. That is coming up. But first, a little BSP, blatant self-promotion. Two little things to tell you about, then one big thing. First little thing, if you go to danharris.com, my new website, there's a merch store up where you can get 10% happier t-shirts and sweatshirts and a tote bag. Also, if you go to danharris.com, you can sign up for my new newsletter in which I share the two biggest takeaways for me from the shows on any given week, plus three cultural recommendations, books, TV shows, movies, TikTok videos, you name it. Okay, here's the big thing I really want to promote. We've got a meditation party retreat coming up at the Omega Institute, which is outside of New York City, that's coming up in May. There's actually another one coming up after that in November. This is a weekend-long thing I do with the great meditation teachers, Sebane Selassie and Jeff Warren. It is not your traditional silent meditation retreat. We call it meditation party for a reason. We do many sessions where we have a lot of conversation among the three of us on stage. We do some guided meditations. We take questions from the audience. It's highly interactive. There's a dance party on Saturday night. We've got a great DJ, Tasha the Amazon, who's coming to play some jams on Saturday night. Come for this. The last one we did was incredibly fun, so we're doing two more this year. Go to eomega.com to sign up or to the link in the show notes. Before I go, I just want to say something about the 10% Happier app. Many of you are familiar with the great teachings of Joseph Goldstein, the amazing meditation teacher. We've got 6 courses and more than 50 guided meditations from Joseph over on the app, including our free introductory course, The Basics. Download the 10% Happier app today, wherever you get your apps, and get started for free. I'll also link to it in the show notes. Audible lets you enjoy all your audio entertainment in one app. You'll always find the best of what you love or something new to discover. They offer an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre. And when it comes to thrillers, they have you covered for any type of excitement you're looking for. With celebrity narration, multicast productions, with immersive sound design, and traditional audiobooks, you will be sure to find a compelling audio title. The book I've been checking out lately is called Devil Makes Three. It's by Ben Fountain. It's extraordinarily well written, and it takes you into Haiti in the 1990s. And obviously, the narrative has a lot of extra punch right now, given what's happening on the ground in Haiti as we speak. Highly recommend this book. Ben Fountain is an incredible writer. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/10% or text 10% to 500-500. That's audible.com/10% or text 10% to 500-500 to try Audible free for 30 days. audible.com/TENPERCENT.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
Hey, Lauren. Hey, Dan. Welcome, welcome.
Hey.
Yeah, hi.
So, Dan, we're going to interview you today.
It is so much easier to be interviewed than it is to interview.
Guess I'm about to find that out, too.
I have so many follow-up questions there, but we'll wait.
I plan to make this as hard as possible for both of you, so you will see.
Just one word answers the whole time.
So when you said beforehand, your guiding principle for the next hour is that we should enjoy this, you meant you're going to torture us and enjoy it.
Yes, I meant I will enjoy watching you suffer, which is the highest form of pleasure. It says that in the Dharma, actually.
Must not have read that sutta yet. Let's introduce Lauren. She has not been on the mic before. So Lauren Smith, producer extraordinaire, do you want to say hey?
Hey, I'm so happy to be here. Yeah, I've been on the other side of this many, many, many times. So this is my debut. And, you know, you guys have done this many times before. So thanks for letting me in to the bromance here. I appreciate
it. Yeah, thanks for being here. I love how your hey was so playful. It was like a 2 a.m. text.
That's what I'm here to bring. That's the energy I'm here to bring today.
Yeah, there were like 7 whys in that hey.
That's very me. I own that.
All right, let's just set a bit of a roadmap here. So this is the kickoff episode in a series that we've been working on for a really long time and we're really excited about. Dan, it's the 10th anniversary of your book, your first book, which, like this podcast, is called 10% Happier. And so we thought it would be fun for Lauren and I to interview you. We'll ask some questions about the book, some questions about the 10 years since, have some fun with it. And at the end, we'll give a little preview of what's coming up in the next few weeks for listeners to look forward to. Dan, does that roadmap sound okay to you?
Yeah, it sounds perfect.
So some of our listeners don't actually know your origin story, Dan, but you are good at talking. So who were you before you wrote this memoir? what are the broad strokes of your story?
Always happy to talk about myself. I will say this has been one of the slightly embarrassing aspects of doing this 10th anniversary rodeo is that, well, first of all, how old I feel, because it feels like yesterday that the book came out. And second, I think I operated under the assumption that people listening to the show read the book. The two of you have helped me realize this. I don't actually think that is entirely or even largely true. There may be many, many people who listen to this show have no fucking idea that I wrote this book or who I am or any of that stuff, which is great. It's totally fine. It's just that somehow the book was such a landmark event in my life, like a defining event in my life, that I narcissistically walk around thinking that everybody, or at least certainly people who listen to the show, would have a passing familiarity with it. And I realize that that's probably not true, and it's slightly embarrassing.
Well, tell us. Tell the people who do not know about your book what led you to write the book.
Okay, yes. That was Lauren's way of saying, can you answer the question I fucking asked you, please? yeah, okay. So I was, for a million years, a news anchor at ABC News. I got to ABC when I was 28. So very young. there's a picture of me that I use in some of my public talks that was taken of me by the security folks in like a basement at ABC News on my first day. And a friend of mine once joked that if you take a wide shot of that picture, it looks like I might be holding a balloon, because I was so young looking and so scared and terrified and wearing this terrible like double-breasted gray pinstripe suit because I was trying to be a big boy at ABC News. After 7 years in local news in Maine and Boston, I got this big break to come to ABC when I was 28. And it was terrifying. It was absolutely terrifying. I'd grown up watching people like Peter Jennings and Barbara Walters and Diane Sawyer. And all of a sudden, you know, they were ostensibly at least my colleagues. And my way of coping with the insecurity that I felt was to become a workaholic. I think I probably already was a workaholic, but at this point, it just really went into high gear. And I had this like running inner monologue of, you know, how good was my last story? What's my next story going to be? Who's getting the story I wanted? What's my relationship with Peter Jennings right now? Blah, blah, blah. And I believed that any success that I was experiencing was directly correlated to the intensity of my anxiety. I had this little motto that was bequeathed to me by my dad, who was at the time an academic physician at Harvard, very successful dude. And he had this little saying, which is, the price of security is insecurity, which is a great thing to tell your children. People are often shocked when I tell them that my dad is Jewish. It's a very cultural trait to venerate worrying in this way. And I subsequently learned that my dad actually made this expression up to make me feel better about the worrying I was already doing. He wasn't actually trying to get me to worry more, but I kind of misinterpreted it and used it to glorify this anxiety that I was experiencing. And shortly after I got to ABC, there was this huge event in the news, which was 9/11. So I arrived at ABC in 2000 at age 28, and then 9/11 happened the next year. And I, really motivated by a lot of my ambition and curiosity and some idealism too, just volunteered to go overseas to cover whatever was going to happen next. And then I ended up spending many years in Afghanistan, Pakistan, Israel, the West Bank, and Gaza. I was there in 2002 during the Second Intifada. So I, you know, the events in the news these days definitely catch my attention in a pretty prominent way. And then I was in Iraq many, many times, often for months at a time. And when I came home after a 6-month stint in Iraq in the summer of 2003, so I was in Baghdad pretty much consecutively from the pre-war, the invasion, and then post-war sort of early flowerings of the insurgency. And that was just my first of, I think, 6 or 7 trips. And I came home in that summer and I got depressed. I didn't actually know I was depressed. I knew I was not feeling well. And so I did something incredibly stupid, which is I started to self-medicate with recreational drugs, including cocaine. And that is what occasioned a panic attack on live television. I feel like I'm doing a lot of talking, so why don't I stop the story there and see if there are any other questions?
That just sounds like a really hard few years. All that time in the war zones, all that time striving in one of the most competitive environments on earth. Like you said, you didn't know you were depressed. Did you know that you were struggling mentally?
You know, it's so funny you say that it sounds like a hard couple of years because I remember those as some of my favorite years of being alive. Mm-hmm. And I experienced it, at least consciously, as incredibly exciting. Mm-hmm. And I remember, I don't think I've ever written about this, but I remember a moment where I was in Ramallah, which is a major city in the West Bank, Palestinian territory, during a period of time when the Israelis invaded in 2002. And after spending a week in this incredibly hairy situation, and where I saw horrifying things, which I didn't enjoy. I'm not here to say that I, you know, got off on the horror or the violence, but it was very exciting and had this illicit feel of being in this place you're not supposed to be, which I've always enjoyed. I've always been a bit of a rule breaker. It had this illicit feel and you get on TV. So it was this very complex cocktail. And I remember getting out of Ramallah and going to my hotel room in Jerusalem and taking a shower and having the thought, I have no problems. That, especially compared to the people I was just spending, you know, I was deeply immersed with these folks who had a lot of problems. And I remember feeling just incredibly grateful that I got to do that job. So yeah, it's just a long way of saying it didn't compute to me that period of time, at least consciously, did not compute as traumatic.
It's really interesting, Dan, because when just hearing you say that, it makes me just think about our body's intelligence and how it'll speak to us when we need it, even if we don't think we need it. You know, bringing us back to you had a panic attack on air. It seems like even though intellectually we're like, this is so exciting, this is an amazing time in my life, I have no problems, there was something confounding in you that was just like, I can't do this, or this is too much, or it was a stopgap for you. And something inside of you spoke. And I'm just curious if that resonates or what you think that moment was when the panic attack happened on air.
Well, it 1,000,000% resonates. I think that's exactly what was happening, and it's an astute observation. You know, I still retain some of the allergy to new age sentiments. So certainly at that age, you know, we're talking about 20 years ago when all of this happened. At that age, I was not in tune with the wisdom of my body or anything like that. I wasn't. Oh, Joseph Goldstein, the great meditation teacher, likes to talk about this line from, I think it's a James Joyce novel, where he describes a character as living a short distance from his body. And I think that was probably true for me. You're absolutely right. I think it showed up in a couple of ways. First, I came home and got depressed and didn't know it. I didn't feel depressed in my head. My body was sending me another signal, and I had a battery of tests. I went to all these different doctors. My parents were doctors, and I was forcing them into these involuntary medical symposia on the phone and trying to figure out why I didn't feel good. I mean, I had my apartment tested for a gas leak, all of this stuff. And finally, I realized I was just depressed. But by that time, I'd already started to self-medicate with cocaine. Mostly that was, I mean, I did a lot of other drugs, but that was, I think, the one that really was the most problematic. And then the panic attack was another way of my body, and specifically, I think in this case, my brain, telling me, we cannot trust you at the wheel of this vehicle anymore. And so, you know, maybe it's worth my describing the panic attack.
Yeah, I think so.
Actually, I had two, but the one that's on YouTube was in 2004. I think it's the first clip that shows up if you Google panic attack on television. It has like a ton of views. It's my most successful video, me losing my fucking mind. What an achievement. So yeah, this was about a year or so after I'd gotten home from Iraq. And I had actually, in that interim period, taken other trips to Iraq. And I'd been given this opportunity to anchor the news updates on Good Morning America. So this job doesn't exist anymore, but there used to be a person, her name was Robin Roberts. She's now the main host of the show. And her job at the time was to come on at the top of each hour and read some headlines. So the main hosts of the show were Diane Sawyer and Charlie Gibson. And Robin, when she was out, I started filling in for her, which was a huge opportunity for me. And it was really going well. I had been doing it for a while and even getting to fill in for Charlie in the big chair. And so but this morning I was filling in for Robin and I started to read the story off of the teleprompter. So there's a teleprompter with these words that float by you. And I was reading the six or seven stories that were on the docket that day. And a few seconds into it, I just started to lose it. And I had had stage fright before, so I knew exactly what this was. I was pre-wired with stage fright. And I'd had incidents that approached panic, but not this strong. And I was trying to get the words out. And I noticed that my heart was speeding up and that my mouth is getting dry and my palms were sweating and I was having trouble breathing. And in response to that, my mind started racing like, you are screwed, dude. You got to get yourself out of this situation. You and all these people are watching and, you know, your career is on the line here. And that just made my physical symptoms worse. And then my mind started racing even more. And you can hear on the tape, I sort of degenerate into incoherence and get my voices kind of breathy. I do kind of hold myself together reasonably well, which speaks to the fact that I'm probably a sociopath, but I couldn't keep going. And so in the middle of the shtick, I tossed it back to the main hosts of the show. Actually, you can hear me tossing it to the wrong hosts of the show. I think I said Robin and Charlie or something like that, but it was actually Charlie Gibson and Diane Sawyer. And you can see their faces in the video. They look like, oh, what's going on here? This isn't supposed to be happening. And they then tossed it over to the weatherman, Tony Perkins. And then Charlie bolted out of his chair and ran over to me to see what was wrong. And all of the people in the control room were getting in my ear and saying, what happened? And I lied to everybody and said that I was fine. I didn't know what had happened, but I knew it was a panic attack. My mom called me backstage. She knew it was a panic attack. And then I started to try to get under the hood and figure out what went wrong.
Did the symptoms subside as soon as you tossed it back, or did it take a few minutes? Huh.
Well, there's the shame and the deceleration period of the heart. But yeah, I wasn't in full panic anymore as soon as I wasn't being watched. I mean, and this is something I only learned recently, like here on this show, actually. Matt Gutman, one of our guests, who's also an ABC News guy, wrote a whole book about panic. And he explained to me here when he was on the show that part of panic is this social component. Our deepest fear as Homo sapiens is rejection, because in the evolutionary times, rejection equaled death if you weren't part of the pack anymore. And so this idea that this was embarrassing, people were going to think I was insane, that shows up now even when I get panic on an airplane or something like that. A big component of the racing thoughts is, these people are going to think I'm crazy when I try to like get out of this plane. And so I think that was a huge part of what was coursing through my mind at the time.
So you knew you'd had a panic attack. I imagine you also knew that that couldn't keep happening if you wanted to have the career that you had. So what did you do?
I tell it in more detail in the book, which is that I went to a shrink after the first panic attack in 2004, but that shrink did not figure out what the real cause was. So I kept partying. And then I had another panic attack, a much more mild one, in 2005. And that's when I went to see Dr. Brotman, who is a pretty big character in the book, who asked me the question point blank, do you do drugs? And I said, yes. And I often joke that he gave me this look, this shrinky look that communicated the sentiment of, okay, asshole, mystery solved. And I think he actually said mystery solved, but he was looking at me like an asshole, not him being an asshole, me being an asshole. And in this case, that diagnosis was correct. Yeah, so in the office with him in 2005, I agreed that day to quit doing drugs, to come see him once or twice a week. I think I ended up seeing him for like 10 years. Actually, you know, when I first started to write 10% Happier, I was not planning. First of all, it wasn't called 10% Happier. I was calling it like the Skeptic's Bible or something like that. And the idea was not to tell my own story. I was really interested in getting people turned on to meditation, because I had started to meditate and I wanted other people to get interested in it, but I wasn't going to make it a memoir. And then at some point I had this idea of like, oh, maybe I'll tell the story about the panic attack. And so I included it in some early drafts. And a lot of my first readers came back and said, give us more of this, because your rhapsodizing about the theory of meditation is not so interesting. But you being an idiot is extremely interesting. So I ended up rebuilding the whole book around what was happening in my inner life, with the goal not of, you know, I didn't have some yearning to write a memoir. I mean, I was in my late 30s when I started writing, so I didn't have an interesting enough life to have a memoir in me. But it just turned out to be the most effective way to make my pitch, which is, because I think at my core, I'm not a memoirist. I'm an evangelical. And my pitch was, or my good news was, that meditation is based in all of this science. it can be good for you. You should do it, or you should consider it. And the memoir was, I came to believe then and still do now, that that was the best delivery mechanism.
There's also a layer, I think, Dan, that our most vulnerable moments can be so life-changing. And that just has a very broad appeal for people in general, even beyond how good meditation can be for you. But to have someone talk about something that's really embarrassing and explain how it led to just a complete life change is really exciting, I think. And we talk about this as a team and we talk about this on the show, but vulnerability is really powerful, even though that can seem a little cringy, but you displayed that and people want to hear that stuff.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I just, there are two thoughts that are coming to mind as you're talking. For sure, it is possible to do vulnerability inappropriately, to like bleed all over the place and overshare. And so I'm always worried about that. And yes, and I was very worried about that with this book. Mm-hmm. And so that's my second point, which is that you have to remember the historical context in which I was writing this book in the early, in the late aughts and early 2010. So it was a 5-year project. The culture was very different. We did not talk about mental health issues that openly at that time. And we certainly didn't talk about meditation. It was not, it had a moment in the 60s, but it had gone back to the fringes. And most certainly, news anchors weren't talking about having panic attacks, being depressed, doing a bunch of blow. That was like not a thing. And I was terrified. My family was terrified. My mom was trying to get me not to publish this book. My wife was incredibly supportive, but really worried. At this time, I was one of the main hosts of the weekend edition of Good Morning America. And I had the thought that it's possible that general managers of the affiliates in certain conservative cities would say, we don't want this guy on our airwaves anymore. Mm-hmm. So I was really scared to publish the book. And I'm not generally that brave, especially not the type of person who is going to willy-nilly take risks with his career. I think there were two things that stiffened my spine. One is I had this incredible confidence that that the important part of the book was not the embarrassing stuff about me, but it was actually the inner technology that had several millennia of rigorous testing in the minds of people on many, many continents. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about meditation, of course. And so it struck me as being worth the risk. And then also my bosses, including Diane Sawyer, and also a guy named Ben Sherwood, who was the president of ABC News when the book came out, they were incredibly supportive. And you know, they read early drafts of the book, gave me notes, told me, go ahead, it's worth it. We got your back. And when the book came out, you know, I think Diane Sawyer did 2 stories on the evening news the week the book came out. And Good Morning America had me on. Ben Sherwood, the boss, basically sent a note to every anchor of every show. It said, you will do this story on your air. And that's what made it a hit.
You said something a few minutes ago about not being a memoirist necessarily at heart, but being an evangelical. And it strikes me that you also would not have published the book if you weren't just so, so sure that it really, really could help people. When did you realize in your own life how potent this stuff was? When did that evangelical part of like who you are latch itself onto meditation? Because at the moment of the panic attack, it wasn't even on your radar.
No. So let me say 2 things. First, I think the best version of me, I think, is around this evangelical thing. You know, like the best version of me is like, let me harness these decades of training I got in network news and in local news to be a storyteller and to be a presenter of ideas and an explainer of ideas. Let me harness that to get out what is essentially a public health message. Okay, that's the best part of me. But the worst part of me, which you guys see behind the scenes occasionally, is driven by fear often, which can turn into kind of overcommitting or greed, acquisitiveness, you know, like wanting to do too many things. And then I get short-tempered and then I'm scary. And so I'm not saying, I think the evangelical thing is real and it's not the whole story. So I just want to be open about that. But yeah, I do. I think in moments where I can get my anxiety under control, either internally through meditation and other modalities, or externally by like having a boss like Ben Sherwood or Diane Sawyer sit me down and say, you're good. Then when I'm relaxed, I think the best part of me can come out, which is helpfulness. You know, I say this all the time. You've heard me say it a million times. You probably have a drinking game for when I say this. But the Tibetan word for enlightenment roughly translates into a clearing away and a bringing forth. And that's at least one of the things that happens in meditation is you're starting to clear away the more noxious tendencies in your mind. Mm. And then what is innate in all of us, which is this, you know, we are wired as a species, so you don't have to take it personally. Like when I talk about the best in me, I'm not patting myself on the back. I think this is a capacity we all have to be useful. And then the luckiest of us figure out some match between our innate desire to be helpful and useful and to matter and what our skills are. That's the sort of good fortune I've had. Anyway, maybe I should answer the question you actually asked me, which is why meditation? They're nodding their heads. Okay, so I had no interest in meditation. None. Yeah. No pre-existing interest in meditation. My parents, who I've referenced a couple of times, were hippies, and they used to drag me to, you know, health food stores and to go camping. And I remember my dad wearing a do-rag, and they were very annoying. I admit they forced me to do yoga classes when I was a kid, and, you know, whatever. So I had some scar tissue around that, and as a result, and that kind of entered into a noxious partnership with one of my less attractive tendencies, which is dismissiveness. I am at baseline dismissive, which is something I've worked on a lot with varying degrees of success. And so if you take my conditioning, a childhood and this pattern of being dismissive, I thought meditation was, I mean, to the extent that I'd ever considered it before, just complete bullshit. And for people who smelled like feet and were really into aromatherapy and Cat Stevens and John Tesh and crystals and whatever. And so after I had the panic attack and started doing therapy, I wasn't like diving into the meditation of it all. That actually happened over the course of a couple of years. Without telling too much of the story, we'll actually, in the course of the next couple of weeks, you'll be meeting some of the key players in that story. But so the TLDR of it is the first thing is I read a book by a guy named Eckhart Tolle. And Tolle is a best-selling self-help guru. And I was reading the book not because I was interested in him for my own purposes, but because I thought he might be a good story for Nightline, which was one of the shows I worked on. And in the book, he made this argument that we all have a voice in our heads, he was not referring to schizophrenia or hearing voices. He was talking about the inner narrator that chases you out of bed and is yammering at you all day long and has you wanting stuff and not wanting stuff and judging people and comparing yourself to other people and judging yourself and thinking about the past or the future instead of focusing on what's happening right now. And Tolle's argument was that this inner cacophony, which if we broadcast aloud, you would be locked up, this inner cacophony owns you if you have no visibility into what's happening. And I found that absolutely compelling. And I realized that this thesis about the human condition explained the panic attack, the most embarrassing moment of my life. It was because I had this inner dialogue fueled by greed and fear and confusion that I went, and some good stuff too. So I went off overseas and started covering war zones. Yeah, in there were some good motivations with, you know, curiosity and idealism and service. And in there were also some ambition and desire. And I did all of this without really taking a proper inventory of what my motivations were. And then I came home, got depressed, didn't know I was depressed, started self-medicating and had a panic attack. So I thought this was such an interesting thesis. And I went and interviewed Eckhart and he turned out to be unsatisfying. That's kind of a story in and of itself that's in the book. And if I can cut to the chase here, it was through subsequent research post meeting Eckhart Tolle that I found Buddhism through Dr. Mark Epstein, who's going to be part of the series in the coming days. You'll hear from Epstein and he becomes a major character in the book. He's a psychiatrist based in New York City. My wife gave me one of his books. And I started to realize that this idea of this monkey mind that we all have was not an Eckhart Tolle trademarked insight. It really dates all the way back to the Buddha. And Epstein has written these beautiful books about the overlap between Buddhism or the Dharma and modern psychology. And I started reading those books, and then I called him up and begged him to be my friend. And there's like a Tuesdays with Maury type vibe with me and Mark throughout the book. And he's explaining the Dharma to me as I'm trying to put it into action in a busy, modern, skeptical life. So to answer your question about meditation, which I keep not doing, meditation itself is a key part of how one manages the ego or the voice in the head, or the inner chaos and cacophony. And it's, I thought it was, it must be some esoteric practice that involved, you know, joining a group or believing in special things, but it really is very simple and has been secularized in the form of mindfulness-based stress reduction, which was invented by Jon Kabat-Zinn, who was recently on the show at the beginning of the year, who is an MIT molecular biologist who was a practicing Zen Buddhist and had this idea that, wait, maybe I can do a secular version of this. And so I started doing it, and really is quite simple. You just sit in a comfortable position, close your eyes, try to focus on your breath. Usually that's what we start with. Doesn't have to be the breath, but often it's the breath. And you're just trying to feel the raw data of the physical sensations of the breath entering and exiting the nose or the belly rising and falling. And then as soon as you try to do this, you will inevitably encounter a sort of mental mutiny where you get carried all over the place by your thoughts and urges and emotions. And the whole game is just to notice when you've become distracted and begin again and again and again. And in this way, a couple of things happen. One, you change the part of the brain associated with attention regulation. And two, you develop a kind of self-awareness that we call mindfulness that allows you to see your ego, your inner narrator or whatever, with some non-judgmental and maybe even humorous remove so that you're not owned by every neurotic obsession that flits through your mind. And there's a ton of data to suggest that this can have beneficial impacts on your brain, the rest of your body, and your behavior, specifically around anxiety and depression. And so all of that, both the experience and the psychological research, is what got me to attach to this practice. So that was like a 10-minute answer to your very simple question.
As you would say, this is a podcast and long answers are totally fine. You talk about meditation, its various benefits, different ways to practice it in the book. And one of the things you talk about is that it gives you this sort of superpower where maybe you've been reacting your whole life and all of a sudden you can respond instead of reacting. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Yeah, I would say the thing in the book that I spent 5 years writing that most people latch onto is this idea of responding, not reacting. We spend so much time like utterly ensorcelled by, utterly enthralled to this chaotic inner dialogue. We act out our thoughts like they're tiny dictators, as the great meditation teacher Joseph Goldstein says. What meditation helps you do is to drop out of the noise, to start to view your thoughts with some distance so that they don't own you. And that doesn't mean that you don't engage effectively in the world. Quite the opposite. You learn to respond wisely to stuff instead of reacting blindly. Most of us are on like just totally controlled by the malevolent puppeteer of our thoughts, when in fact, we have this inner capacity to view the contents of our consciousness with some mindfulness, with some self-awareness, and without being totally attached to them. And to me, that's kind of the big headline of the book. And then what you see me do is fuck it up repeatedly.
I've never personally seen that, but yeah. Yeah.
Of course.
I want to hand things back to Lauren in a sec, but just one more question. I heard you say just a second ago, you said we have this inner capacity. Is that true for everybody? I know people come up to you all the time and say, meditation sounds great, but it's not something I can do. You know, my mind, too busy. Do we all have that inner capacity?
I love when people say that to me. Those are my people. I stole that that turn of phrase from Sharon Salzberg, because she says the same thing. Sharon's a great meditation teacher. Yeah, I think that's very common. People have a sense that their mind is crazy, that they're like eminently distractible, or maybe they even tried meditation and very quickly saw that the mind is busy. I sometimes joke that it's like trying to hold a live fish in your hands, that it's just going all over the place. And they see that and wrongly conclude that that means that they have some sort of bespoke lunacy. I call this the fallacy of uniqueness, that somehow they and only they cannot meditate. When in fact, evolution most likely wired us to have this racing mind because it kept us safe on the savannah and other places where we were evolving. And so the point is not to clear your mind, which I think is the most damaging misconception about meditation. As you've heard me say a million times, clearing your mind is impossible unless you're enlightened or you've died. The point is not to clear your mind. The point is to focus your mind for a few nanoseconds at a time on something neutral, like the feeling of your breath coming in and going out. And then every time you get distracted, you start again and again and again. And that getting distracted, that waking up from getting distracted, is not proof that you're failing. It's proof that you're doing it right. Because the whole game is just to notice how crazy the mind is, to notice what your life is actually about. You might think your life is about service or loyalty or whatever, and that's true in a certain way. But if you pay attention to your mind, mostly what your life is about is like, what's for lunch? And did I miss the latest Bravo show about Real Housewives? And where do gerbils run wild? And, you know, blah, blah, blah. Or you're planning a homicide or whatever it is. That is what's happening in your mind on a moment-to-moment basis. And what this process does is help you wake up to that so that you can make better decisions. Coming up, we're going to talk about some of the aspects of my own personality that I've learned about along the way that needed to change. And DJ and Lauren will weigh in on whether I've been successful from their point of view. And we're going to talk about why our faults are not our fault, but they are our responsibility. The weather is getting warmer. Time to ditch my jackets and sweaters for shorts and tees. I used to waste my money on clothing that would only last one season. That was until I found Quince. Now I've got high quality pieces that never go out of style that I will be wearing year after year. Quince has all the seasonal must-haves like 100% European linen shirts from $30, performance polos, and versatile flow knit activewear. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices, along with premium fabrics and finishes. I just made a big order at Quince.com. I got two pairs of sweatpants that I've just had for like a week, and I already love them. I'm wearing them all the time. Sweatpants are a huge deal to me because I work from home and I want to look reasonably good, you know, in front of my wife and stuff, but I want to be comfortable. And the Quince sweatpants do the trick. For me, the bottom line is they've got good looking stuff at low prices. Not a bad recipe. You should go ahead and upgrade your wardrobe. Go to quince.com/happier for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/happier to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/happier.
When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/happier. Just go to Indeed.com/happier right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/happier. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Looking to deepen your meditation practice with a dash of both wisdom and humor? Dive into the 10% Happier Meditation app. Download it for free wherever you get your apps and get started today.
How successful do you think you are, Dan, at operationalizing this in your like daily interactions?
I mean, I have a lot of good news on the score, although maybe I'll press DJ into answering that question. I am reasonably good, but there's a reason why I called the book 10% Happier. Like I don't see perfection as being on offer. Maybe there is such a thing as enlightenment, full enlightenment, but I have no evidence for that. I certainly haven't experienced it. So what I think is genuinely on offer is marginal and consistent improvement. As long as you understand that you're going to have bad days. So it's not a steady upward trajectory of improvement. It's more like a sort of an up and down zigzaggy line. And so absolutely, if I haven't slept enough or if I'm anxious, particularly around money stuff, that's a big trigger for me. I can do some very dumb things, or I can be short, or I can push people too hard. And this kind of impacts people like you who work with me. And so this is a big thing that I talk to my shrink and talk to my executive coach, Jerry Colonna, and talk to my wife about, talk to my brother. People talk to Joseph Goldstein, the great meditation teacher, who's also featured in this series and in the book in a big way. Like I try to work on this, but I'm not perfect at all. And so the good news is I do think I and anybody can get better. And so this is just another example of like, yeah, I use my story, but I'm not that interested in my story ultimately. Actually, I get pretty tired of telling this story over and over again, but I love talking about the universal aspects of it. And it is, I believe, a universal that we all have the capacity to grow and change. In the book, there's a whole set of instructions at the end. And it basically just teaches you how to meditate. And I actually went and revised and changed it and for the new edition. But I kept something from the first book, which is that I end it with I used to be a huge, this is going to show my age, but I used to be a huge buyer of records and CDs. And I used to go to Newbury Comics, which I think is still there on Newbury Street in Boston. It was my favorite record store. And I would love to see which albums were coming out soon, because there was no internet in the 90s, or at least in the early 90s. So you'd have to go to the store to find out like which band was going to, you know, was Guided by Voices or Pavement. Are they going to be putting out a new record soon? And above the list of new releases, there was this great little pithy little expression: all dates can change, so can you. And I love that because that is true. Now, I think there are probably some people who have mental health disorders that makes this harder. And I would say if you have mental health issues, first of all, you're not alone. Many of us, sadly, an increasing number of us have them. And you just might want to work with your mental health professional if you have one to make sure that this practice is safe for you. But I do believe that generally speaking, the capacity to change is a universal. DJ, you have fewer compunctions about pissing me off. So, I know you've seen me on many a bad hair day. So it's not like you're working with some like perfected guru here.
Yeah, that's true. And, you know, I think one of the complicating factors is like you move through most spaces in your life and certainly through this space with us, with just a huge amount of power, right? And so
yes,
me having a bad day means something different than you having a bad day, right? I don't know. I think my experience of you is like your practice is real. You take it seriously and it bestows on you a level of self-awareness that allows you to do a couple things that I've seen you do. One is like check your bad impulse in the moment, which you sometimes do. Another is like name the bad impulse almost immediately after it surfaces. And another is like name it a little later than that, but still name it, right? And it just takes a lot of the charge out of whatever the behavior is or the impulse is that you have that ability to either interrupt yourself before you do the thing or name it really quickly, right? So sometimes that means you just acknowledging like, I'm pretty tired right now and I'm a little frustrated, and like that might come out sideways and it's not about you. And you just kind of set the table that way as a way to like give everybody a sense of where you're at, right? And other times you'll say like, you'll be a few minutes into a conversation and be like, hey, I think I came in hot at the top and like, my bad, you know? And so I think like, I don't know, that's kind of all you can ask for really in a world where, like you said, perfection's not on offer. And I also like, I walk through space with less power than you, but still certain amounts of power in certain respects. And I don't know, I just really empathize with you. Like I am reactive sometimes too, you know? I check my bad impulse a minute too late sometimes too. Yeah, I can say after like 3+ years behind the curtain that like the things you say on the podcast feel genuine, and there's not like some other sinister you lurking that like doesn't meditate and doesn't care about anybody.
I mean, that's my nightmare. First of all, thank you for that. And I'm sorry to put you on the spot. And my point in that was not to get you to push you to praise me in any way, but actually quite the opposite, which is to show I want to give people permission to continue to be schmucks, right? Like that, just because you're engaging in self-development, spiritual growth, whatever, does not mean you should expect yourself to be perfect. That's just another form of, you know, delusion. And so really that was my goal. And so I appreciate you playing along. And you know, the power of it is a really important aspect that I'm glad you pointed to, that that I honestly did not take into account for a long time. And didn't want to look at because I'm uncomfortable having power. And so now I see it more as like a responsibility. Well, in my best moments, I see it more as a responsibility to other people. But you know, forgetting is a huge problem. We talk about that a lot on the show, that DJ and Lauren have a drinking game that they would probably be chugging around this thing that I'm about to say, which is that one of the original translations of the word sati, which we now translate as mindfulness, is recollecting or remembering, because forgetting all the inspiring shit you might hear on this show or in great books or whatever, we're wired for that, for forgetting and denial, and the culture militates against all of the wisdom that you might pick up in certain places like the show or great books or whatever. And so I can forget. And I try to remember, but there are times in my next book, I'm writing about an incident in which that involves a staffer who's no longer with us. She passed away, where I was mad at her for like 3 months and she was right. And I only recently really started to take into my bones that she was right. And, you know, I have a lot of regret around that. That kind of ugliness is definitely still in me. And again, I'm saying this trying to be helpful, just to say that this is a slow process. In any Orthodox Buddhist tradition, they'd say this is a multi-lifetime affair. You know, the way we talk about the Buddha is that, you know, there are all these stories, the Jataka tales about his prior lives. And so this guy, again, I'm not saying you have to believe in any of this stuff, but the way the Buddha is talked about is as a guy who was messing it up for lifetimes until he got enlightened.
Yeah. This thing you just said about like how long it took you to admit that someone else was right, just it calls to mind for me one of, I think, your most effective tricks in this arena, which is you just make it a habit to constantly name the fact that like there's probably information you don't have and there might be something you're not seeing clearly and you might be wrong about the thing you're about to say before you say the thing. And I could be reading you wrong here, but I think sometimes that comes from genuinely felt in the moment humility. And sometimes it comes from just like knowing that that's a good thing to do, even if you're pretty sure that you're right. But it really does make a difference. And it's just like a great hack, even in the times when like you might not mean it at all. Like saying it is a reminder, even just to you, I think.
I'm glad you point that out, because I've been given the feedback before I met either of you. I got rather pointed feedback that when I said I could be wrong, it was a clear signal that I did not believe I was wrong and I was going to say something to prove that. And so I would say one of the fruits of my practice that has showed up in the years after the book came out, in the 10 years, is that I have decreasing confidence in my own correctness. And there's a long history of people praising intellectual humility. You know, Yeats said, the best among us lack all conviction. You know, this is a quality that we praise, but it's not one in our current culture that we actually reward that often. We live in the middle of a time when like certainty is really rewarded and like the loudest, all caps, obnoxious version of that. And I, as somebody who came out of the media where that is definitely rewarded, did not bring to this game the best conditioning for intellectual humility. But the practice of like consistently being confronted with the madness of your own mind will, if you let it over time, give you a kind of, I think, attractive and helpful lack of dogmatism. I mean, the Buddha said, I am not a dogmatist, I'm an analyst. He also said, those who cling to their views and opinions travel the world annoying people. And so I do try to take that on board. And at my worst, I fall back into the like spouting of I could be wrong, but not actually believing that.
The one thing I do want to say that you're really good at, Dan, is creating a culture where even if it feels hard for all of us, we are encouraged to also speak our vulnerability or any kind of messy feeling. And I think that that is something that you've modeled and it feels connected to this. Like, you're not perfect. Let's talk about it instead of letting this narrative just run the show in the background. Let's get it out there in the space, in the room, so that we're not just being led by these stories in our heads. And I think that that is something that I have experienced and is very interesting in a workspace. And I don't think necessarily very common.
I appreciate that very much. And I feel a little sheepish for having forced you guys into this situation. Like, remember those Trump cabinet meetings when he would force all the cabinet folks to like say positive stuff about him? I don't want this to be a hostage video.
We really like you, Dan. We like you so much.
Exactly.
So I'm not much. A monster.
Guys, I don't know. You can't see them. I'm not sure if you're listening to this, you can see them, but they have fire emojis shooting out of their eyes. So I came to this through screwing it up. Another note I got was that I was actually rude to junior staffers, which was humiliating. This was came in a 360 review I did many years ago. And it really pointed out that I was rude and dismissive and impatient and not creating, I believe the term of art is psychological safety with people. And so it is not my default mode to do that. I've had to train myself and I still screw it. Lauren doesn't want to say it, but I still screw it up, you know, semi-regularly. So these are just lessons that I've had to learn. And a lot of it is by, you know, being on, doing this show. Again, I always thought of the show for the first few years as, you know, an interesting little postscript on the book, but the book was the thing. And now I think this podcast reaches more people in a 6-week period, if I'm doing the math correctly, than have ever read the book. And so this show has become like one of the main events of my life. And it's basically me getting free therapy and talking to people who are interesting. These lessons about vulnerability and psychological safety and communication skills, you know, I'm trying to do what I hope the audience is trying to do, which is knit them into my lives.
When I hear you say that thing about how, for example, creating psychological safety is not your default mode, I just want to like point to one thing in there. Not to make you feel better, but because it might be of service to other people, which is like this notion that your default mode is somehow harmful, but also that it's like yours is like also something that like I've learned to question through the practice and through listening to the guests on our show, right? So like one version of the story is like Dan's selfish, Dan like wields power irresponsibly, like Dan fails to create psychological safety because Dan's default is bad, right? And I know you have spoken openly and often about how you have this sneaking suspicion that you are somehow irredeemably selfish or bad, right? And all of that conditioning, the selfishness, the rudeness to junior staffers, like everything you're talking about, there are causes and conditions for that, right? There's things that you learned in your time at ABC News and before that. There's things that you learned from your parents, your schooling, your teachers, the culture, the media. There are things that are baked into our DNA as people, like our defaults to fear and anger, or as like the Buddha would say, greed, hatred, and delusion. And so it's like your default mode isn't really yours in a way, right? It's like you have to take responsibility for it, but you don't have to tell yourself the story that, in the same way that like someone is not, doesn't have a uniquely racing mind, like your default mode is not uniquely reflective of something bad about you.
I mean, gold star. Yes, that's it. I mean, that is one of the main thrusts of the Dharma. There's a great Burmese master who was the teacher to many of the folks who've been on the show, like Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield. His name was, he's no longer with us, Sayadaw U Pandita. And he used to say, the mind is not yours, but it is your responsibility. And that can sound esoteric, but it's really as simple as this. As DJ was saying, everything that's happening right now, every event rests on the lip of a wave on an unfathomable ocean of causes and conditions dating back to the Big Bang and maybe before. And when you view things with that perspective, it's hard to take your shit very personally. And so I spend my life now, like not all of my life, but a big percentage of my life telling my own embarrassing stories, not because I try to make them interesting, but not because that's the point, but because I'm trying to get people to see that you don't have to take your own inner mishigas too personally. And that actually the real liberation is to start to see it as something that's impersonal. Doesn't mean you don't have to take responsibility for it, but you don't have to add on the whole story about how this is you irrevocably, et cetera, et cetera. Coming up, how the book's success has changed my life and how it feels now to find myself in the role of quasi self-help guru. I want to tell you about a podcast you should check out. It's called ADHD Aha, and it's hosted by Laura Key. It's candid stories from people who share the moment it clicked that they or someone they know has ADHD. It can be hard to understand what ADHD is by looking at a list of symptoms. In every episode, you'll hear heartfelt interviews about the unexpected, emotional, and even funny ways ADHD symptoms surface for adults. I checked out an episode of ADHD Aha, and I thought it was quite moving to hear from a guy who talked about learning when he was in the fifth grade that he actually had a diagnosis and that he wasn't, as everybody else had told him, including his teachers, dumb. This is actually not dissimilar to something I've seen with my wife, who lived with ADHD undiagnosed until her 30s and harbored real suspicions that she was unworthy. And then getting that diagnosis was massively clarifying for her. To listen to ADHD Aha, search for ADHD Aha in your podcast app. That's ADHD Aha with Aha spelled A-H-A. Check it out. The good folks from Tidy Care Alert sent us some kitty litter in the mail. That's not normally the kind of thing you want to get in the mail, but when you have four cats, it's actually a very exciting development. So we've been using Tidy Care Alert, and our cats seem to be very happy. They're pooping away very happily. Tidy Care Alert has long-lasting ammonia control, so your house won't smell like you have cats. It's low dust and lightweight, and it's from the brand most often recommended and personally used by veterinarians. Tidy Care Alert uses color-changing crystals to detect potential concerns and help you put your mind at ease. Let Tidy Care Alert help keep an eye on your cat's health. Whether you have one cat or you're a crazy person like me and my wife and our son, and you have four cats, they make it easy to track. Tidy Care Alert.
Dan, your life obviously has changed significantly since this book came out. And one of the things that I find most interesting is that you've been turned into this kind of quasi self-help guru. And I'm curious, how do you feel when you hear that, first of all? And are people coming to you for advice all the time? How do you see yourself? How are you comfortable as someone who's like a voice in the wellness field? And what do you even think about that word wellness?
That's a great question. I initially had a lot of imposter feelings about it. And you know, I have so much respect for meditation teachers who, as you know, I'm married to a doctor. My parents are doctors and have a lot of respect for doctors. And they go through so much training. I lived with my wife when she went through residency. And then I think 3 or 4 years of fellowship after residency before she became a full attending physician. And meditation teachers go through, I think, more training, you know, years of silent retreat. And I have not done that. So I really... I really worried about this initially, and I didn't even know whether it was okay for me to teach meditation when I was giving talks. Just to be clear, when the book came out, I thought it would come out, make a little blip, maybe even not much of a blip, and then go away. And then it ended up being way more successful than I suspected, and it led to this podcast and a meditation app, and I still do a lot of speeches all over the place. And I was worried about, you know, was it responsible for me to teach basic meditation? And then answer people's questions about it. And I had a big talk with Joseph Goldstein about this. And he said, yeah, first of all, it's totally fine for you to teach basic meditation. And then when you answer people's questions, as long as you keep it in your experience, it's fine. You know, don't pretend you know more than you know. Just use I language to be, I don't think he said this, but this is one of the communication skills that I've learned, that if you keep it in like your own personal experience, you're much safer because you can be an authority in your own personal experience. Now, 10 years that have passed, and I increasingly feel comfortable with, I would, you know, quasi guru is right. You know, that I mean, I have not done the training to be a full meditation teacher, but I have done some training, and I do one or two silent meditation retreats a year, often 10 days. I've written a couple of books on the subject. I host this show 2 to 3 times a week. So I do feel like I can give some advice, with the caveat that I'm not a doctor, I'm not a psychiatrist, I'm not a psychologist even. And within that context, yeah, I can channel what I've learned, filter it through my own personal experience and share that. And if I take that approach, I do feel comfortable. And I like, you know, I like being the guy that my friends call if they have a problem. Yeah, I like that a lot, actually. And I do spend a certain amount of time at the beginning of those conversations explaining all the stuff I don't know. And then once I've done that, I feel better about saying what I see.
You said something a few months ago, I think it was just when the team was at dinner, and it just popped out to me because I wasn't expecting it, which was, you talked about how the book, or at least at the time that you were writing it, you felt like it had a kind of punk rock feel to it. And I'm curious, like, what you meant by that, and if that still feels like an animating spirit for you in the work you're doing now, especially given everything you've just said about how you've sort of established yourself as the sort of go-to person.
I love that question. It's something I've been thinking about a lot, and I would actually like to get some feedback from the two of you on it. I'll say a few words and then be interested to hear what you think. For sure. Well, first of all, I've always loved punk rock. A lot of these records behind me in my little studio here are, like, I guess you would technically call them sort of alternative or underground rock from the 80s and 90s. Bands like the Minutemen and the Replacements and Sonic Youth and Husker Du, and then in the 90s, like Guided by Voices and Pavement. So I've always loved that, and I've always been very attracted to interesting worlds outside of the mainstream, and that was a huge theme in my journalism. You know, I definitely covered big mainstream events, and but I really loved, especially in the later part of my career, was diving into the world of, like, the underground drug trade in Rio, or the child slave rings in Haiti, and busting American pedophiles prowling in Cambodia, and these strange and often sometimes not so great subcultures. It's always been very interesting to me. And so that finding new ways to see the world and talk about the world has always been important to me. And when I started getting interested in meditation before the book came out, I was really intrigued by the science and by the practice, and very annoyed by the books I was reading, because there was this syrupy, saccharine tone. And so I tried to write a book that used the F word a lot and told embarrassing stories about cocaine and, you know, had a sort of eyebrow-raising title, because I thought that was the way to break through. Because again, remember the cultural context, there was a lot of skepticism generally in the culture at that time about meditation, to the extent that anybody even thought about it. So I thought, well, if I'm an evangelist, I need the right language. You know, the Buddha was very good at this. You know, he he was on the scene during an agrarian time, and he would use farm or very down home like analogies and metaphors in his teaching. If he was talking to people who worship fire, he would talk about the Dharma through the lens of fire. I do think that's an important thing, to talk to people in ways that they're likely to listen. Where I'd be interested to hear your points of view is that I think over time, I've been off at times because I think the culture has moved and there is less skepticism about meditation. And sometimes I've got these habits and this conditioning from that first book that may not be relevant or serving me so well now. Lauren, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I'm just thinking how like my favorite versions of you, Dan, are when you're like earnest and not in that mode. But also I think it just speaks to what different people are drawn to. I think that there's something about knowing that you had so much skepticism and then watching that soften and seeing you open is exciting to see for me. And maybe that's just my own personal preference, but I have a feeling that other people might feel similarly.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Thank you. I think there's something to what you're saying. On the one hand, I got so much feedback, especially early on, that the skepticism was so important for people. Like, oh, well, if this guy's going down this road, maybe I can go with him. And I think especially for people like my age and older, you know, I'm a Gen X, like I think still that's very important. And yet I think for younger people, especially because younger people most humans are younger than me, but I'm referring to, you know, anybody in their 30s or below, that, as you guys know, there's so much suffering going on right now. People are not bringing skepticism to tools that could help them turn down their anxiety or depression. They really want them. And so I don't need to gild the lily or dress it up with, you know, too much profanity or skepticism, because that actually is, that it's discordant to many audiences. So I'm increasingly trying to figure out how to straddle all of this and be effective and be real, because I am a guy who swears a lot and I do like making jokes, and it's about thinking about the appropriate time and place for all of that.
That's so interesting. There's probably never going to be a right answer there. That question will probably be alive for as long as you are, or at least as long as you're doing this work. Yeah, we hear from people all the time, like, thank God you got rid of the bleeping. It's nice to hear the authentic Dan. And we also hear from people all the time that's like, stop cursing. It's not mindful. I had to turn it off. Like, it's ruining my equanimity, you know? And those are just two things that are both true at the same time. I guess when I think about your skepticism, I think like, yeah, we might be in a time when you don't need to work as hard to signal that you're not going to be using syrupy language and we're not going to be super precious about this. Like, that just might not be as important as it was 10 years ago. But I think that the spirit of like, how do we really reach people and connect them to practices that can really help still needs skepticism, because we now live in a world where mental health conversations and meditation conversations are everywhere and they're for sale everywhere. And there are a lot of claims being made and there are a lot of products being sold and there's a lot of conventional wisdom being peddled. And so we still need to be skeptical, but maybe just in different ways. Like, are we talking about trauma in ways that are good for people or bad for people? Are we talking about trigger warnings in ways that are good for people or bad for people? Are we talking about, is talking about anxiety all the time actually helpful, or is it making people more anxious, right? So like, we still need the skepticism. And I think there is an echo chamber that we can sometimes fall into where we get pitched a guest and they've got this great pedigree and their book has been blurbed by 10 people who have been on the show before. And it just feels like an obvious home run. Are we losing a little bit of the skepticism that you started with? Like, do we need to be pushing harder on what are really the best ways to be talking about this? What are really the most useful practices? So yeah, I think it's got to stay. It's just got to like bob and weave and change and be impermanent like everything else.
Yeah, I think what I'm hearing you both say is something like, there's healthy skepticism and maybe a corrosive skepticism. Healthy skepticism that you're pointing to is like rigor and careful thought. Mm-hmm. And an unhealthy skepticism might look like cynicism, or it might look like glibness and lazy profanity and easy jokes. And so I don't think we're heading into a world where I don't say fuck anymore or I don't make jokes. But I was talking with Joseph about this just the other day. He was saying that some people don't like how my sign off on Instagram is inner peace, motherfuckers. But, you know, if you look at the comments, some of the people in his world don't like that I say that. But if you look at the comments on those videos, they're just like, people are like, make me a t-shirt that says that. And you know, we were talking about, when is it appropriate to do this? When is it skillful and useful? And when is it not? And I don't have clear answers. I'm just trying to figure that out.
I think your earnestness lands well, though, with that as the backdrop.
Yeah. Yeah. So I think it's like, what you're pointing to is some sort of wise combination.
Yeah. Like everything in life, right?
Yes. This is another, you know, TPH staff drinking game I'm sure that they could play. But I'm always talking about this Esther Perel expression that I love. Esther Perel is the great couples counselor who's been on the show a million times. I love her so much. And she talks about how some things are not problems to be fixed, but dynamics to be managed. Mm-hmm. And I think we've just identified one.
I love that.
So yeah, maybe before we let folks go, Dan, can you just give us a preview of what's coming up in this really exciting series that we've been working on for so long around the 10th anniversary?
We are doing a big and ambitious series here on the show. Very grateful to DJ and Lauren for doing a ton of work. One of the guiding principles that we've talked about a lot is that we didn't want this to feel just like rote and repetitive promotion for the book. And so, yeah, we are celebrating the fact that there's a new edition of the book coming out, a revised edition of the book, and that's fun for us. But these episodes are meant to stand on their own as value add for you, the listener. And so there'll be a thin veneer of, hey, this is part of this series. But mostly it's about just doing something useful and interesting for you. So the theme is that we're just going back and talking to the key players from the book. And it's not so much about talking to them about their experience being in the book. That would be pretty boring. We're just talking about the things they're interested in now. So we're just producing a bunch of new episodes that we would produce at any time, but we're just kind of lumping them together in this series. So we're talking to people like Joseph Goldstein. And when I asked him what he wanted to talk about, he said that he's increasingly interested in talking about esoteric aspects of Buddhist cosmology, like karma and rebirth and even superpowers. And so we actually had a fascinating discussion about this. And it's not the type of things that modern Dharma teachers, especially in the West, really go into. And he goes into it. We talked to Deepak Chopra, who plays a bit of the role of a foil in the book. I make fun of him a little bit. And so I was interested to see what do I make of him now, 10 years later, and is he mad at me? And so you'll hear the results. We talked to Spring Washam, who's a great meditation teacher, who I also kind of make fun of a little bit in the book, although she turns into a hero. And subsequently, she and I have become quite good friends. And so we're talking to her about, should you go on a meditation retreat? It's something that people talk about a lot and increasingly people are interested in it. So what do you need to know before you go? Should you even go? We're going to talk to her about that. I talked to Dr. Mark Epstein, who I mentioned earlier, and he's got fascinating things to say about the Buddhist concept of emptiness or not self, which we were talking about earlier, like this very hard to grok idea that you shouldn't take the contents of your mind personally and how that can seem scary or weird, but actually it should be deeply comforting. And then finally, well, we talked to my brother, Matt, who plays the role of skeptic in the book, who's making fun of me for getting into all this stuff and is now, to my great delight, a very dedicated Dharma practitioner. I have joked that there's times when he comes to me to talk about meditation and I have this Buddhist phrase that comes through my mind, which is, I fucking told you. That's a really fun conversation, very satisfying for me. And finally, now that I'm just shamelessly promoting everything here, I do want to say that we are doing a live show in New York City. We're going to have a band and some very special guests, many of whom you just heard me talk about. So you can come celebrate this in person. This is also just kind of in keeping with us running a bunch of experiments lately. So this kind of idea of doing a live party, I'm interested to see how it goes. So come join us. All the information's in the show notes.
Awesome. Thanks for letting us grill you. This has been a fun turning of the tables today.
We should do it more often. You guys are really good at this.
Well, We learn from the best, don't we?
I think I just threw up in my mouth a little bit.
I'm here to bring the earnest energy too. Come on.
You guys are the best. This has been an amazing series. It's also been a great conversation. So thank you.
Sweet. Thank you, Dan.
Thank you. Yeah,
thanks for having us.
Thanks again to DJ and Lauren. We've got many more great episodes coming up. Deepak Chopra, Joseph Goldstein, Mark Epstein, my little brother. It's going to be great. 10% Happier is produced by Gabrielle Zuckerman, Justine Davey, Lauren Smith, and Tara Anderson. DJ Kashmir is our senior producer. Marissa Schneiderman is our senior editor. Kevin O'Connell is our director of audio and post-production, and Kimmy Regler is our executive producer. Alicia Mackey leads our marketing, and Tony Magyar is our director of podcasts. And finally, Nick Thorburn of the great band Islands wrote our theme. If you like 10% Happier, and I hope you do, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman, from Wondery. Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time, and in our newest season, we track the power struggles within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it all says about the future and safety of artificial intelligence. Make sure to follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dives and daily business content, listen to Wondery, the destination for business podcasts, with shows like The Best One Yet, Business Wars, and many more. Let me tell you, Wondery means business.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.